Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Hardly a week goes by without a mass shooting in America. Not a single day goes by in this country without an incident of one-on-one gun violence. As you know, here in Charlotte, our homicide rate is alarmingly high, with guns being the weapon of choice. After each heinous mass shooting, people have demanded that our leaders do something. What we get back is thoughts and prayers, but no action. The double mass murders in El Paso and Dayton seem to have moved the needle at least a little. Even the president is on board in supporting red flag laws that would allow police or family members to ask courts to order the temporary removal of firearms from someone who may present a danger to themselves or others. But Congress is in recess. Here in North Carolina, red flag laws have stalled in our legislature. The gun lobby is remarkably strong at all levels of government, but there are signs their strength may be weakening, due at least in part to the efforts of our guest this hour. Following Sandy Hook, Shannon Watts became an organizer on Facebook. That led to the founding of Moms Demand Action. She also wrote a book, Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. A big promise, but one that is beginning to bear fruit. Shannon Watts is bringing her push to rein in gun violence to Charlotte tonight at 7 at Johnson C. Smith University, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are going to be here to moderate a community conversation about gun violence as Charlotte continues to grapple with a growing number of senseless homicides committed by young people who generally know their victims and who are solving disagreements with firearms. But you founded your organization, Moms Demand Action, as the result of a different kind of gun violence. As I just said, perpetrators committing mass murder. Are these two phenomena somehow related, do you think?
Well, yes, there's something that ties all gun violence in America together, and that is easy access to guns. Whether it's a mass shooting or a school shooting, the daily gun violence in city centers or rural communities that suffer from gun suicides, all of it is tied together, and it gives us a 25 times higher gun homicide rate than any other high-income country, and that is easy access to guns.
How many more guns do we have in this country as opposed to other industrialized nations that allow guns?
Well, we have a very high rate of guns per capita. There are about 400 million guns in this country, one for every man, woman, and child. There are other high-income countries that have a high rate of guns per capita, but the difference is that they also have incredibly strong gun laws. And look, if more guns and fewer gun laws made us safer, which is what the NRA alleges, we'd be the safest country in the world. And as I mentioned, we have an incredibly high rate of gun violence.
You started your organization after the Sandy Hook tragedy, and now you have chapters in every state in the union. And your group is also part of something called Every Town for Gun Safety, which is the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country. I think they have 5 million supporters. Your group has 6 million members. You started, as I understand, your group started with your urging that all Americans can and should do more to reduce gun violence, and yet the gun violence continues. Does that dishearten you or hearten your resolve?
Look, this is going to take several election cycles. I always say this work is a marathon, not a sprint. I got off the sidelines after the tragedy in Sandy Hook and wanted to create something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but for gun safety, that could go toe-to-toe with the gun lobby. And we have done that in just 6.5 short years. You know, the NRA has a several-decade head start. And this doesn't happen overnight. We are making huge strides in state houses and in boardrooms, and we're all waiting for this cathartic moment in Congress. I understand that. But Congress is where this work ends. It's not where it begins, and that's why we have to pass good gun bills in state houses, stop bad gun bills that the NRA has really been insidious in passing for so long, and get companies and influencers and athletes and others who hold sway in our culture to get off the sidelines too.
I mean, you were a mom folding laundry when Sandy Hook happened. And there were mass shootings prior to Sandy Hook. But when Sandy Hook occurred, where these precious children were mowed down by a mentally unstable individual in their classrooms in an elementary school, we thought, most of us thought, well, that's gonna move the needle. If nothing moves the needle, that will move the needle. These are kids. It didn't happen. When innocent people in Las Vegas got mowed down by a deranged guy up in a hotel room, nothing moved the needle. When Congress was attacked on a baseball field, that didn't move the needle. How do you explain that?
Well, when you say move the needle, what you're talking about is Congress acting. And what we have seen is that the way you move the needle is to build momentum on the ground. And we have created this political powerhouse that has a chapter in every state of the country, hundreds of thousands of volunteers. And for example, after the Parkland shooting tragedy, our organization tripled in size, and we were able to parlay that new growth into political wins. We had the best year we've ever had in 2018. We passed stronger gun laws in 20 states, 9 of which were signed by Republican governors. And we are seeing the gun lobby's strength diminish significantly. So all of these shooting tragedies do move the needle, whether it's people deciding that they've had enough and getting involved, whether it's state lawmakers standing up to the gun lobby. We have to get involved in electoral politics, all of us, so that we can get the right president and Congress in place that will act. But until that work that happens, there's still incredible work being done on the ground.
It may be too early to tell, but it did appear that following the shootings in El Paso and Dayton on the same weekend, that the needle did move a bit, that the president got on board. He made comments about having spoken several times with members of the NRA or leaders at the NRA about these red flag laws. And he felt, and Mitch McConnell has said that when Congress comes back from recess, he may have them take up those laws. Do you think that the El Paso and Dayton shootings put us at an inflection point in this fight?
I believe it was a very important inflection point because Republicans and Democrats alike realized that this is a crisis. We've seen at least 5 Republicans in Ohio change their hearts and minds on this issue, including the governor. We've seen Congress members in other states like Tennessee say that they regret voting against background checks and think the Senate should vote on this issue. So that's important. We're also seeing Americans get off the sidelines. We're having rallies all across the country coming up this weekend to put pressure on the Senate to act. But all that said, 90% of Americans support stronger gun laws, 80% of gun owners, 74% of NRA members. If the Senate doesn't do what they know they should do, there will be hell to pay in the 2020 elections. And so we don't give up. If the Senate doesn't do what they should, we press on and we push them.
Well, the governor of Ohio, following the shooting in Dayton, got up to speak to a crowd, and he started talking about what all politicians seem to talk about after this. So we have to give our thoughts and prayers to these individuals who lost loved ones in this tragedy. And the crowd began to chant, "Do something." And I think it was the very next day that he took some action at his state's level. When you see a crowd chanting down an elected official for their lack of action, what does that tell you?
Well, it should tell these lawmakers that their constituents have had it, and that when the overwhelming percentage, majority of constituents support common sense measures that we know save lives, like background checks and strong red flag laws, that they're, you know, if they do the right thing, we'll have their back. But if they don't, we will have their jobs. And we have proved that time and time again over the last 6.5 years.
You know, America has always had guns in abundance. We have the Second Amendment. But in Chicago, in Charlotte, here in Charlotte, more and more people are resorting to using firearms to solve menial disputes. And of course, almost every week, it seems, someone uses them to shoot up a crowd somewhere in a Walmart or on a baseball field or at a movie theater. Why do you think this is happening now? What has changed? This didn't happen in the 1960s. There were guns in the 1960s. This didn't happen in the 1980s. There were guns in the 1980s. The murder rate has been higher and lower over time. But what is it going on right now in America that's causing all this to happen?
Well, it's a confluence of a few things. First of all, there's more than double the number of guns in this country in circulation than there were in 1968. So that's a big part of this issue. The other piece is that we have a gun lobby that has held sway over our lawmakers for far too long. Essentially, gun lobbyists have written our gun laws. And so they are incredibly lax. And you can do things like carry a semi-automatic rifle, tactical gear, 1,000 rounds of ammo into a Walmart, and it's perfectly legal. And so we have absurd gun laws combined with easy access to hundreds of millions of guns. And this is the logical outcome of that. You know, road rage involving guns has more than doubled since 2015. So we're going to continue to see these kinds of tragedies happen if we don't act.
People will say, or some people will say, that something happens in a person's brain when they decide, for whatever reason, to pull the trigger and kill people, whether it's a one-on-one shooting over a menial disagreement or it's a mass massacre. President Trump, when he talked about these mass shootings in Texas and Ohio, said, mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun. But experts in mental health say that most people who are mentally ill don't pick up guns and shoot people. They're likely to shoot themselves, but not others. Mental health, we certainly have a problem with that in this country, but is that being used as a scapegoat to avoid the real issue in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. You know, every time this happens, even after Sandy Hook, we always hear from politicians beholden to the gun lobby that this is the result of mental illness. We know that mass shooters, in only about 5% of all cases, show any signs of mental illness pre-shooting. We also know that people with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violent crime and not the perpetrators. We also know that other high-income countries have similar rates of mental illness. And yet, as I mentioned, we have a 25 times higher gun homicide rate in this country. So all signs actually point to easy access to guns, but blaming the mentally ill is a convenient scapegoat.
Your organization has met with success in getting governments to act. You've lobbied members of Congress and members of state legislatures. You've pressured CEOs of private companies. What have you been able to accomplish? Talk about that.
It's been incredibly significant. In just the last 6.5 years, we have passed dozens and dozens of strong gun bills. We've closed the background check loophole in 21 states now. We've passed something called a red flag law in 17 states. We've passed laws that disarm domestic abusers in 28 states. On top of that, every year we stop hundreds of bad NRA bills. Last year we stopped over 1,000. These are bills like arming teachers, putting guns on college campuses, stand your ground, permitless carry. And these are bills that would have sailed through state houses if it weren't for Moms Demand Action volunteers showing up and putting eyeballs to their lawmakers and saying, not in my community, you don't. On top of that, we have worked with companies to change their gun policies. Over a dozen restaurants and retailers have stopped the practice of open carry because of Moms Demand Action. And now what's so interesting is that companies are actually coming to us instead of us having to drag them into this issue kicking and screaming and asking how they can be part of our coalition.
Shannon Watts is our guest. She's the founder of Moms Demand Action, and she will be in town on this evening to do a forum about gun violence at Johnson C. Smith University. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Shannon Watts is with us. She's the founder of Moms Demand Action. It got started right after the Sandy Hook shootings in 2012. 6 million people are in the ranks of Moms Against Moms Demand Action. Are all of them moms, or are there some men in that group too?
We call ourselves Mothers and Others. So much like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, we have volunteers and supporters who are men and non-moms. There's nothing that makes me happier than seeing a man in a Moms Demand Action t-shirt. Really, this is just about letting women lead on this issue. You know, we only make up about 20% of lawmakers in this country, about 5% of Fortune 1000 CEOs. So this is a way for us to pull the levers of power available to us. But we are open to all Americans who care about this issue.
You just went through a litany of things that your organization has been able to achieve in the last 7 years. A lot of people looking at this onslaught of mass shootings that never seem to end would say that nothing has gotten done. Clearly, you have been able to make some inroads somewhere. How would you put what you've been able to accomplish into the context of how far we need to go if you want to stop this kind of violence?
Well, the issue with our nation's gun laws, it's really sort of a patchwork across the country, and you are only as safe as the closest state with the weakest gun laws. Guns pass over state lines as easily as cars do. So that is why we encourage the federal government to act, to put stronger laws in place, like closing the loophole that allows unlicensed gun sales without a background check, or putting in place strong red flag laws that allow a temporary restraining order to take away the guns from someone who seems to be a danger to themselves or others. These things are proven by research and data to save lives. So in the meantime, we have to go state by state and pass them and strengthen the gun laws. But it really requires a federal solution.
Well, what is it about what you do and how you've done it that you think you have been able to make inroads, and you have, when others have not? What has been your process with the people with whom you've had success in moving toward a different solution?
Well, first of all, we are a nonpartisan organization. So we work across the aisle to get lawmakers on board. As I mentioned, of the 20 stronger state laws passed last year, 9 were signed by Republican governors. The other thing that's unique about our organization is that everything we do is based on research and data. So the laws that we support are proven to save lives, and they're also proven to be constitutionally sound. And the other piece of it is, I think that women are the secret sauce to organizing in this country. When you look at activism, starting with women being allowed to be involved in prohibition because temperance was considered to be a Christian value, we've never stopped and we've never let up, all the way to the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Women have always been on the front lines of change in this country, and I don't think gun violence is any different.
You have said that you wanted to be part of an army of, quote, badass women.
And I am.
Is that what it takes to get the attention of organizations like governments and businesses that are primarily controlled by men?
I think it is. You know, women are the majority of the voting electorate, and men that are in office and that are making the laws that protect our families and communities feel an obligation often to listen to us. They want us to stand with them and to support them. And they're also scared of us when we don't. And I think seeing dozens or hundreds of Moms Demand Action volunteers showing up and saying, we're going to hold you accountable for whether you protect our families, has really a lot of resonance. And it was, you can look at Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which was so influential in the 80s, to see that this is a valuable and effective recipe.
You're also part of a generational shift. I know that this probably would not have happened in my parents' generation, particularly with my mother and other women like her, because they simply wouldn't have done it. And they would have been intimidated to come up against these lawmakers. You told Mother Jones that if you spend any time in a, this is a quote, if you spend any time in a state house, you very quickly realize that these are not rocket scientists. I would trust very few of them to get me a cup of coffee, let alone make the laws that protect my family and my community. Wow.
And yes, this is so incredibly true. Really, I encourage everyone to spend a few hours in their state house, and you will realize that as a woman, as a mom, you are more than qualified to be a lawmaker. And really, that's part of what we've done, too. You know, 40 of our volunteers and gun violence survivors ran for office in 2018. 17 won, everything from city council to Congress, including Lucy McBath, who is now a congresswoman in Georgia. And we should not be intimidated. We should move from shaping policy to actually making it.
But I'm just curious about how you make inroads with the people who are in office, not the people who may come to office because they've seen what you've seen in state houses around the country and realize, hey, I can do this. But how do you make friends with the people who are holding those offices when you're sure not trying to make friends? If you don't, if you say publicly you don't trust them to get you a cup of coffee, they're not going to be your friend.
You know, they politicians often just want to keep their jobs. That's the bottom line. There's some of them who are in it because they're incredibly passionate about what they do, and they're willing to make risky votes because they believe that there is a moral clarity to what they do and ultimately what their promises to their constituents. However, many of them are just there to keep showing up, to keep their jobs. And look, I'm fine if these lawmakers decide that they support us due to political expediency. They don't have to have a change of heart and mind. If they just simply see which way the polls are showing that they should vote, that's fine too. And so we have conversations. We show up at every gun bill hearing. We show up at every rally. We show up at town halls. And we're wearing our red shirts and we're making sure this issue is always front of mind for lawmakers and for their constituents.
Shannon Watts is our guest. She's the founder of Moms Demand Action and the author of Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. She'll be in town tonight at 7 o'clock to speak at Johnson C. Smith University as part of a public conversation on guns, a public health crisis. You have been called the NRA's worst nightmare. Is that because of how effective you've been or because you and other mothers, women, bring a dynamic to this argument that is unlike any other? The fact that everyone murdered as the result of gunfire is some mother's son or daughter.
I think that's a very powerful point. And I believe the NRA's worst nightmare was that women and mothers would organize around this issue and be effective and credible. And the fact that we outspent and outmaneuvered the NRA in the 2018 midterm elections just goes to show you that we are on the rise and the NRA is on the decline. We have much more political power. And look, the NRA has been hobbled by a variety of things, whether it's the fact that they're running out of money or that they're under investigation or they have turmoil inside their organization. All of that is really going to help us be successful in 2019 and 2020 elections.
Well, you just said that the NRA is in trouble, and they are. It's no secret to anybody. It's all over the news that they're financially in trouble, and there's trouble at the head with Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA. You told The Hill that the NRA is weaker than it has ever been in its history, while the gun violence prevention movement is stronger than it has ever been. But even if your side wins, what impact will a change in public policy, either at the state levels or eventually at the congressional, the national level, have, given the fact that those guns will still be out there and easy to get?
Well, there's definitely a demographic shift, right? So there were a lot of guns bought by a small amount of people. In fact, about 3% of gun owners own over half of the 400 million guns in this country. So the gun lobby convinced them that they needed an arsenal. That demographic is aging out. It's a white man over the age of 50 or 60. And we're seeing a demographic shift. And that's why the NRA has changed their agenda. In 1999, the NRA opposed guns in schools. They supported a background check on every gun sale. And the reason that changed was because they realized they had to sell more guns to more people in order to maintain gun manufacturers' profit margins. That's why we saw them shift to wanting to arm teachers, which would be incredibly lucrative for the gun lobby, and all of the other extreme items on their agenda. So this is really about restoring the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. And having stronger gun laws in a country that, as you said, has so many guns per capita.
So what are those responsibilities? I will wager you, I could be wrong about this, and you can correct me if I am, that the 3% of people who own most of the guns in America are responsible gun owners. They're not the ones blowing up, shooting up Walmarts. They're not the ones taking their gun out on a Friday night when a drug deal goes wrong and shooting the other guy involved in the transaction. These people have their guns. They like their guns. They lock them up in gun safes. They only use them for hunting or target practice or recreational purposes. They don't harm other people. So what is the responsibility that you're talking about here?
Well, the vast majority of gun owners in this country are responsible, and they do support a background check on every gun sale. But 29 states don't require a background check on every gun sale. So, for example, that puts women in such a vulnerable position because domestic abusers have such easy access to guns. Even if they've been convicted, all they have to do is go to a gun show or buy a gun online with no questions asked. So restoring that background check on every gun sale across the country, putting specific laws in place that will protect Americans, like a strong red flag law, requiring domestic abusers to relinquish the guns they already own. That's something that we work on at a state level. But also responsible gun storage. 4.6 million American children live in homes where guns are not responsibly stored, meaning that they're not locked, they're not unloaded, they're not separate from ammunition. And so all of these responsibilities are not required by law.
You're up against the lot. Anybody who fights the gun lobby is up against the lot because they have a lot of money at their disposal and they have been entrenched for a very long time. And untangling the connections they have with lawmakers at all levels is not something that's easy to do. And you have said that motherhood can be used as a weapon against you unless you use it as a tool. What does that mean?
Well, you know, the NRA has attacked me. The NRA leadership has attacked me ever since I started doing this, and implied, you know, that I don't know what I'm talking about or that I'm not a real mom because I'm an activist. All of these different sort of sexist tropes that they rely on to appeal to their base. And all of that has really become white noise. Even the threats of death and sexual assault to me, to my daughters, to our volunteers at large, because we will not allow a vocal minority to silence and intimidate us. That's the purpose of that kind of behavior. And look, there is no going back. We are going to have gun safety in this country, one way or the other. And it is just, it's inevitable and it's a matter of time. So we keep focused on what the goal is, and that is saving lives.
I want to underline something you just said. You have received death threats. Others in your organization have received death threats. I take it these are anonymous, but they're coming from people who are in favor of the Second Amendment or who are gun owners. Is that who they're coming from?
They're coming from gun extremists who believe that any law at all is an infringement on the Second Amendment. Again, it's not the majority of Americans, even the majority of gun owners who support stronger gun laws. But the NRA has cultivated this very vocal minority of gun extremists who become enraged when anyone tries to pass any kind of law, even if it's proven by data and research to save lives.
Most of the people involved in these mass shootings are men, young men. A lot of them have a history of domestic violence. The New York Times recently reported that one of the common threads that connect many of these shooters is a hatred of women. As a mother, have you given this any thought? I mean, what do these connections tell you about potential solutions?
Yeah, I mean, women are 21 times more likely in America to be shot and killed than their peers in high-income countries. Over 50 women are shot and killed every single month in America by former or current intimate partners. There is a crisis of gun violence against women in America. And as Nicholas Kristof, the editorial writer at the New York Times, says, in other nations, brutish husbands put their wives in the hospital. In America, they put them in graves. And that is, again, in part because of easy access to guns. Every nation is home to misogynists or domestic abusers. Only America gives them easy access to arsenals and ammunition.
You know, one of the things that angered you in the aftermath of Sandy Hook was watching pundits and politicians on TV assert that the answer to this crisis of gun violence is more guns. And you've just talked about that a moment ago. Some people after Parkland High School, as you said, advocated arming teachers. That conversation was held here in North Carolina as well at the legislative level. Obviously, you strenuously disagree with that. But why do you think they believe the answer is more guns? Is it as simple as the NRA being entrenched, or the gun manufacturers finding looking for new markets for their product? Is it just that, or is there more to it than this?
Well, you have to remember that the NRA has helped create this crisis for gun manufacturers, because there's no longer a boogeyman in the White House to make gun owners afraid every time there's a shooting tragedy in this country that their guns will be taken away. So since Donald Trump was elected, gun manufacturers are over $100 million in the hole. They have to find a way to make up those profits. And one way to do that is by arming just a fraction of America's 5 million school teachers. The idea that school teachers will somehow be trained to be sharpshooters is absurd. When you look at studies of police officers, it shows that less than 30% are able to shoot and accurately hit a moving target due to adrenaline and other reasons. And the idea that we're going to just minimally train teachers, put a gun in their hand, and somehow enable them to take out a mass shooter in a classroom full of students is just absurd.
But what do you tell people who genuinely believe that they look at these reports every week of mass shootings and they say things like, well, if somebody there had had a gun, it would have been ended like that, because somebody would have pulled out their gun and blown the shooter away. If that's their argument, that the answer is everybody be armed, everybody have more guns, and there'd be less gun violence. If that's not the answer, what is?
Well, again, when you compare America to other high-income countries, those countries do not deal with school shootings, and they certainly don't arm their teachers. And as I mentioned, data shows that even police are unable to shoot a moving target 30% of the time. So the data and research shows us that the solution is actually keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people. It is not to arm school faculty.
So much more to talk about in terms of the research that has been done or has not been done, and that's a key to this, to tell us the real facts. The real facts lie in data, and the data is sparse. We'll talk about that when we come back, among other things, with Shannon Watts. She's the founder of Moms Demand Action and the author of Fight Like a Mother. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The political world has its attention on the presidential race, but local elections coming up will have a bigger impact on the day-to-day lives of Charlottesians. 7 Democrats are on the ballot for city council at large in next month's primary. So join Charlotte Talks for a live forum with the candidates Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. And send your questions for the candidates in advance to charlottetalks@wfae.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Shannon Watts. She's the founder of Moms Demand Action. She's in town tonight at 7 o'clock to speak at Johnson C. Smith University as part of a public conversation about gun violence, but particularly here in Charlotte, it being a public health crisis. She's also the author of Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. Background checks. Let's talk about that, because this seems like a very simple thing to do and a sensible thing to do. You've said that it would make an immediate difference if we did this, and it seems like a no-brainer. Do you understand the argument against background checks? I mean, what is that argument, and what is your argument in favor?
I actually don't understand it. So licensed gun sales in this country go through a background check. However, unlicensed gun sales, so dealers who are not licensed to sell guns at gun shows or online, are not required to have a background check. That means millions of guns are sold in this country every year without a background check. And that is a very simple loophole to close. We've closed it here in Colorado. In the last 10 years, about 8,000 prohibited purchasers were stopped from buying a gun thanks to a background check on every gun sale. That means lost money for the NRA when they can't sell guns for the NRA and gun manufacturers. So I understand why they're opposed to it. The reason they give is that somehow this will create a registration or put undue burden on gun owners, which doesn't make a lot of sense given that they're already required on license sales.
I want to come back to these numbers that you cited just a moment ago, that 90% of the country and 80% of gun owners and 74% of NRA members favor background checks. That was that those numbers come from a Republican poll. Why then isn't this national law?
Well, because we have some lawmakers in Congress who are beholden to the gun lobby. And we have worked very hard over the last 6.5 years to loosen the stranglehold of the NRA finger by finger on those lawmakers. But that takes several election cycles. And for example, when we prove to the NRA that and lawmakers beholden to them that we can outspend and outmaneuver the NRA like we did in the 2018 midterm elections, it sends a strong signal. This doesn't happen overnight.
And you think I'm guessing here that background checks would be an immediate improvement. You've pointed out on more than one occasion that our gun laws are certainly out of whack. Do you take issue with the Second Amendment? Should the Second Amendment continue to stand?
We support the Second Amendment. Many of our volunteers are gun owners or they're married to gun owners. Again, this is not about being anti-gun. This is not about wanting to dismantle the Second Amendment. This is just about restoring the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. Hmm.
And you do point out the absurdity of some of our gun laws. You used an argument at Starbucks, am I right?
Yes.
Getting them to change their policy. They allowed, in states where open carry was the law, where it's permissible, Starbucks would let you come in and order a cup of coffee with a gun on your hip. And you took objection to that. What was the logic that you used that made them change that policy?
Well, look, when open carry is allowed, and the recent incidents inside Walmart's prove this point, when open carry is allowed, and it's allowed in 45 states, and retailers like Walmart don't address it as a policy, they allow it as well, then what happens is customers don't know when someone comes in with an AR-15 if they're a good guy or a bad guy. And that should never be in question. And so Starbucks was allowing this practice in 2013. We asked them to stop. We embarked on a 3-month campaign. And that's all it took for them to come out and say, not only was open carry not allowed, but they no longer welcomed gun inside their stores. And we've replicated that at over a dozen restaurants and retailers.
Yes, so you told them that you and your followers were more afraid of secondhand smoke, more afraid of secondhand bullets than you were of secondhand smoke, and they had already banned smoking in Starbucks.
That's right. That's right. And it just is a logical safety precaution to protect employees and customers.
What about the argument made quite often by people who are gun owners and who are advocates of everybody being armed, that because the country would be safer if we were ready to take out the bad guy? What about that? What do you say to those people who are convinced that I should take my gun into the Howard Johnson's, if there still is one, because if something goes on, I'll be ready?
Well, when you look at the data over and over again, it shows that mass shooters are not taken down by an armed citizen. In most states, in most places, Americans are allowed to conceal carry. And often these shootings happen so quickly that even the police have a difficult time taking down someone who is armed to the teeth and has a death wish. I mean, if you look at the Dayton shooting, the gunman shot 26 people in 32 seconds using an AR-15 that had been modified and had a 100-round ammunition drum. So the idea that someone with a handgun can take out, again, a gunman who is armed to the teeth with a death wish is just proven to be very unlikely.
Well, the fact, and this was actually shocking. I mean, you know that these guns, these automatic weapons, these military weapons, these assault weapons are capable of doing great damage and firing multiple rounds in a very short amount of time. But when I heard what you just said, that 26 people were shot in 32 seconds, it really underlines the question of why those guns are in the hands of people other than soldiers. What is the argument for that kind of gun to be owned by ordinary people. What is the argument for that?
Well, I mean, the reality is that there's a very high profit margin on AR-15s, and gun manufacturers had saturated the handgun market. So that's really the bottom line as to why the gun manufacturers promote AR-15s with advertising that says things like, consider your man card restored. This is about marketing and advertising. But what the NRA says is that the AR-15 is an important weapon for self-protection. Yeah. But there should not, culturally, it is obscene, and these weapons should not be on the streets or in the hands of civilians.
Let's for a moment take people who say they want to be able to carry a gun, either concealed or open carry, and certainly have them in their home. Just take it for granted that they do have a genuine concern about their personal safety. Let's take that at their word. Are you a gun owner?
I am not.
You have had death threats. Why do you feel safe?
Well, data shows that having a dog, an alarm, is actually the most effective thing you can do to protect yourself. The data also shows, and this was before the NRA was able to get Congress to stop doing much of its research on gun violence, but the data showed that having a gun in your home actually put you more at risk of suicide or gun homicide. And we know that a gun in the home of a domestic violence situation makes a woman 5 times more likely to be shot and killed with that gun. So the data does not show that guns actually make you safer, but that is your Second Amendment right. And as I said, many of our volunteers are gun owners or they're married to them.
Well, most of the people who carry guns or say they want them to protect for self-protection have not received death threats. You have. What would you tell them? If you're not afraid, if you don't feel the need to carry, why not?
Well, again, I feel confident that my dog and my alarm system has me covered, but I would never argue with someone that they shouldn't have a gun in their home for self-protection. I would argue that they should store it safely, that if they have children, it should be locked and unloaded and separate from ammunition. But that's a choice. What we're talking about is the unregulated gun use in our country that allows a gun sale without a background check, or it allows easy access to guns for domestic abusers, and on and on and on. It's really not about someone who has a gun in their home for self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Following El Paso and Dayton, even the president, as I've said, seemed less intimidated by the NRA, to the chagrin of some other politicians. He said he was in discussions with them. I don't know whether that's true or not, but he said it. And he said he believed that some headway could be made, either with the NRA or with Congress or both. Do you think, how can I phrase this? Do you think the president was telling the truth about this? Or was this just something that he says because he says things that he personally believes that have no foundation in fact sometime?
Well, the president is a wild card on this issue and has gone back and forth. If you look at his history before he became president, he supported gun safety. The NRA gave his campaign $30 million, one of the largest outside donors to his campaign. So they expect a return on investment. They have not been able to pass any of their priority legislation, but they certainly have his ear when it comes to times like this. If the president is serious about wanting stronger gun laws, all he has to do is pick up the phone and insist Mitch McConnell allow this legislation to have a vote.
Really? Wouldn't he be in jeopardy? I mean, the reason this doesn't happen is because of politics. And yes, there's some money involved perhaps between the NRA and politicians, but there's a big question about the base, and the base that he appeals to, that the president appeals to, are probably, many of them, NRA members. Would that play with the base?
Well, that's what they're trying to decide right now. They're looking at the fact that 90% of Americans support stronger gun laws. Many of those people are Trump voters. And they have to make a political calculus as to whether they believe the vast majority of Americans are more powerful and hold more sway than gun lobbyists. And that's those are the discussions that are taking place right now.
You have 6 million members in your organization. How many members does the NRA have?
They claim to have 5 million, but that has been debunked over and over again. If you sign up for a magazine, a gun magazine, or you join a shooting range or you buy a gun, you're often required to join the NRA as a member. As I mentioned, their demographic is aging out, so many of those members that they claim to have are no longer alive. So we don't really know.
So then you have more members than they have.
We are larger than the NRA.
How do you know that?
Well, because we can compare. They claim to have 5 million. Media shows that they have less. And we know that we have 6 million supporters. We have hundreds of thousands of volunteers. Look, when we show up at state houses, it's not dozens or hundreds of us versus dozens or hundreds of NRA members. It's typically us versus one or two NRA lobbyists.
So you have the numbers, and numbers mean a lot, but you don't necessarily have the funding. And it's not just the NRA you're up against. You're up against the manufacturers. Have you been in conversations with, I don't even know who makes guns, Smith & Wesson, for instance?
Well, gun manufacturers sort of hide behind the NRA, and they aren't interested in any middle ground. At least we haven't seen that happen. But we have over 350,000 donors, and we are able to fund this grassroots movement that way. We don't have to worry about the things the NRA worries about, like having a TV channel, which is now defunct, or having magazines, or all of the advertising they have to do to promote their organization and sell guns. We simply have to fight them at a grassroots level.
Do you take that money? How do you use the money that you have? I'm not sure how much money you have, but how do you use it?
We spend money working on legislation efforts, electoral and legislative politics. We also fund litigation to take on the NRA in different cities and states where they're sued by the gun lobby, and also to educate people. We have a program called Be Smart that educates gun owners and non-gun owners alike about responsible gun storage. So all of our grassroots activities are funded by donors.
Some are hoping that Dayton and El Paso was an inflection moment. You've said that it may have, in fact, have been an inflection moment. If we're witnessing movement in Washington against the NRA and toward your point of view, is that because we have reached the point where it is clear to most people in this country, including some NRA members, that we are all in danger as long as we maintain the status quo? Or is it because of some weakening of the NRA's stranglehold on Congress as they go through their internal struggle?
I think it's two things. It's that we have, for the first time ever, a grassroots movement that can go toe-to-toe with the gun lobby and that has made huge inroads over the last 6.5 years. But the other piece of it is that the NRA is truly hobbled by the investigations into their tax-exempt status, their misspending and mismanagement of their money, hundreds of thousands of dollars on suits and private jet travel for their CEO. They tried to buy him a $6 million mansion in Dallas. You know, this is not something that even their members can support. So yeah, we go into the election cycle stronger than we've ever been, and they are weaker than they've ever been.
The PBS NewsHour reports that no one really knows if gun control laws save lives, because in 1996, Congress passed the Dickey Amendment, which prohibited federal funds from being used to conduct research that could inform anti-gun advocacy. This year, the House passed legislation to fund federal gun violence research, an effort that has, surprise, been stalled by the Senate. Does the fact that lawmakers don't want data on the efficacy of gun control legislation send a message that maybe they already know the answer?
Well, we do know the answer, because the data showed very clearly in the 90s what was causing our gun violence crisis, and that was easy access to guns. And that's why the NRA got Congress to stop allocating funding for it. But when we look at the states that have passed stronger gun laws, we see lives saved significant through gun homicide, gun suicide, unintentional shootings. When we look at states that have weak gun laws or that have undone their strong gun laws, like Missouri, we see gun homicides and gun suicide spike. So we can look at the states and see what works and what doesn't. But certainly it would be helpful to have federal funding for studying gun violence.
How can rank and file people, ordinary people listening, make a difference?
Well, first of all, you know, get off the sidelines and join us. And again, you can be a mom or a non-mom. And you can go to our website, momsdemandaction.org, and join us. We are going to have rallies this coming weekend all across the country, where we'll meet with our senators in district and encourage them to do the right thing on this issue now. And keep in mind, we have so many important elections coming up, not just in 2020, but in Virginia this year. Every single seat is up for election in the General Assembly. So we're also gearing up for electoral politics cycles.
Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.